Discover the tips and strategies that will help you achieve your retirement goals. I'm your host, James Knoll, and this is the podcast dedicated to helping you retire well. It all starts right here on Ready for Retirement. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Ready for Retirement. I'm your host, James Knoll. On today's episode, we're going to be talking about what investments you should be owning within your retirement portfolio, because you've probably heard me and you've probably heard many people talk about large cap and small cap and international and domestic and bonds and stocks and real estate. And at some point, you want to know, what does all that actually mean? I get conceptually there are different types of investments, but what types of investments are they really? And how do each of these investments play with one another or interact with one another? And that's what we're going to discuss on today's episode. And today's episode was brought to me by a listener named Craig. And Craig said this. He said, "Hi, James, I'm 59 and a half years old. I had a major surgery this past June of 2022, which got me thinking about retirement. I found your podcast on Spotify and started listening to them from the beginning. And wow, they are very informative. Easy to follow information that gave me comfort regarding my retirement planning. So thank you. I have a good general knowledge of stock types, but I was wondering if you would give us a basic education on the different types of stocks and funds, i.e. mid-cap, small-cap, large-cap, growth, value, dividend, blue chip, etc. Your education is helping a lot of us understand how to live well. Thank you, Craig." All right. Well, thank you, Craig, for that question. I hope the surgery went well, and I'm glad to hear that you found the podcast and that it has been helpful. And this would be a wonderful thing to talk about, so we'll do just that on today's episode. Just a quick request, if I may, before we jump in, if you've enjoyed the show and if you have not left a review yet, please do so. It helps more people find this show, and I get lots of great feedback from all of you saying how much it's helped you or friends or family or coworkers. So leave a review, share it with coworkers or friends or family, would really appreciate that. And if you haven't already done so, make sure to check us out on YouTube under Root Financial. You'll have this episode as well as other supplemental and additional information there about how you can best plan your retirement. So with that, let's jump in. Now, high level, when it comes to investing, there are literally thousands and thousands and thousands of stocks or funds or ETFs or things that you can purchase. So as an investor, it can very quickly get very overwhelming when you look at this and say, well, what on earth am I supposed to do with all these things as I'm trying to plan for my retirement? Well, let's look high level. High level, most of these things, almost all of these things, can be broken down into one of two categories. You are either a owner, owning a company, owning real estate, owning some asset, or you're a lender. You're lending your money to a company or to a government with the promise of being repaid with interest over time. So when you're constructing a portfolio, it's those two things that you're starting with. To what extent are you going to be an owner, and to what extent are you going to be a lender, because they have different characteristics and benefits to them. Let's start with the ownership side. When you're an owner, we all know people that own a business. Maybe you own a business. It makes sense. You own that business, and the cash flow, the revenue, the profits from that business, you have a right to them. Those are yours. You get to keep those. Well, the same thing holds true with the stock market. If you go buy a stock in McDonald's or Apple or Chevron or whatever it is, you literally own that company. You're owning it with millions and millions of other people, but as those companies are generating revenue and profits and paying dividends, you have a right to that as an owner. Now, the company can increase or decrease in value based upon how it's run, based upon all kinds of different market factors, but you own that company. And with that ownership comes much greater growth potential, and with it comes more uncertainty when we're comparing it to being a lender. Now, when you're a lender, you are lending your money to a government or to a corporation, and that government or corporation is saying, "Hey, James, thanks for your money. We're going to pay you some interest rate a couple times per year. And then at the end of whatever the term of this loan is, we're going to pay it back to you." This is called a bond. When you purchase a bond, you're lending your money to some institution with the promise of repayment along with interest over time. So those are the two high-level things that we want to talk about. And when you hear people talking about owning maybe a 60-40 portfolio or an 80-20 portfolio or 100-0 portfolio, really what they're saying is, what percentage of your portfolio is you being an owner and what percentage of your portfolio is you being a lender? 60-40, for example, that's 60% stocks. You might hear them called equities. So you own it, you have equity in it. in 40% bonds. That's you lending your money to some institution. Now, let's start with the ownership piece. When you're an owner, what types of things can you own? Is it just owning all the different stocks because they're all created equal? Well, no. To Craig's point, there's large companies, small companies, growth companies, value companies. What does that actually mean, though? What makes a company large versus value versus small versus international? Well, there's a handful of things. Let's start with large U.S. companies. So large in this context means $10 billion or more in total market capitalization. So the total size of the company is greater than $10 billion. So as we're talking about this, this isn't your brother-in-law who has maybe a couple, few dozen employees at his company. That's a big company in comparison to other small businesses, but it's not a large company in the context of investing like we're talking about here. $10 billion is a very sizable company. So when you're looking at a large U.S. company, it's a U.S. company that's headquartered here in the U.S., in the total size, so size is measured by what's the stock price, multiplied by the number of shares outstanding. If the size of that is larger than $10 billion, it's considered a large cap stock. Large cap staying for large capitalization, and that's $10 billion or more. Now, what tracks that? Well, the S&P 500 is an index that mostly tracks that. And I say mostly because about, as of today, about 450 of the companies in the S&P 500 are larger than $10 billion, and the other 50 and change, it's not exactly 500 companies in the index, but about the other 50 or so are medium-sized companies, which is defined as anything between $2 billion and $10 billion in size. So for example, if we look at the S&P 500 today, the largest company as of this recording is Apple. Apple is worth $2.3 trillion. Now when you look at that, there's 500 companies in the S&P 500, but they're not all split up evenly, meaning they don't make up an even amount of the S&P 500. The S&P 500 is market cap weighted, meaning bigger companies will make up a bigger share of the index as a whole. Apple, as of today, makes up about 6.6% of the S&P 500. Now, if we look at number 500 of the companies in the S&P 500 today, it's DaVita. Now, DaVita is a provider of dialysis services. And by the way, these rankings, they can change daily because these are stocks that trade on a daily basis and a few percentage points jumps here or there that can quickly change this. But as of today, just for context, DaVita is the smallest of the companies, or it's number 500 of the companies in the S&P 500 in its market capitalization. So its size is about $6.5 billion. And for comparison, Apple makes up 6.6% of the S&P 500. DaVita makes up 0.01% of the S&P 500. So a 1% increase in the price of Apple stock, it's going to have a greater impact on the S&P 500 as a whole than will a 1% increase in the price of DaVita. And again, that's because it's market cap weighted. So for some further context, a 10 times increase in the value of DaVita today, it would equal about a 0.1% increase in the S&P 500, all else staying equal. A 10 times increase in the value of Apple, it would equal about a 66% increase in the value of the S&P 500. So when people are talking about large cap stocks in the S&P 500, it's mostly a proxy for large cap stocks because most of the stocks in the S&P 500 are technically large companies. And more than just that, if you look at those 450 companies, they're going to have a greater weighting on the S&P as a whole. So in general, the S&P 500 is a very good proxy for the return you can expect on large stocks. And going back to the initial question that Craig mentioned, he said, what are these different types of stocks? There's large cap, there's dividend, there's blue chip. Well, I would say many of the companies in the S&P 500 would be considered both blue chip and dividend stocks and large cap stocks. So none of those things are necessarily mutually exclusive. Dividend just means it pays a dividend, which about 85% of the companies in the S&P 500 do. Blue chip means it's kind of one of those big established companies that we've all heard about. It's maybe the Apple, it's the Johnson & Johnson, it's the Intel. It's those companies that are just there and they're solid and they're likely going to be in business for a very, very long time. And that's how a lot of the companies in the S&P 500 are. You've heard of them. The largest company is Apple. The smallest, or number 500 as of today, is DaVita. Number 250, so right in the middle, is Walgreens. Many of these are companies that you're familiar with because you interact with our products and their services on a daily basis. And just a quick side note and kind of an interesting thing here is going back to the market cap weighted piece. The S&P 500, as of today, is down about 17.5% on the year. So as a reminder, companies like Apple or Google or Microsoft, price changes in those companies will have a greater impact on the value of the S&P 500 as a whole than will price changes in companies like DaVita, so one of the smaller ones in the index. Because of that, if you look at the S&P 500 on a market cap weighted basis, like it typically is measured in, it's down 17.5% so far this year, like I said. If you look at the S&P 500 equal cap weighted, so you take the 500 companies in there and they each represent, what would that be, 0.2% of the S&P, but they all get equal share, that index would be down about 11% year to date. The reason for that is so many of the companies at the top, they have actually been hit harder this year. And because of that, it's dragged the index performance down more so than it actually would be down if you just look at the individual components of each individual stock had they each had separate or equal weighting in the index as a whole. So kind of a side note there, but that being said, that's what we look at with the S&P 500. And historically, the S&P 500 has returned around 10% per year. Now, it's not 10% every single year, and in fact, it's gone long periods of time where it's underperformed that. From 2000 to 2010, it's referred to as the lost decade, because not only did the S&P 500 not average 10% per year during that decade, it actually lost 1% per year for an entire decade. So total return of about negative 9% from January 1st of 2000 through January 1st of 2010. If you looked at the S&P 500 in 1929, it dropped at the beginning of the Great Depression. It took about 14 years to recover if you include dividends being reinvested over that period of time. So even though it provides wonderful long-term returns, and if we could count on those returns every single year, there might not be much reason to diversify, but we can't count on those returns every single year. And in fact, we can't even count on those returns every single decade. So that's why I would never just recommend owning solely the S&P 500 or just large cap stocks here in the US. So let's talk about other types of investments. Well, if the S&P 500 primarily makes up large companies that are here domestically in the US, small companies are excluded from the S&P. And small companies are typically stocks that have a market capitalization of less than $2 billion. So again, large companies are $10 billion and more. Medium-sized companies or mid-cap companies are $2 billion to $10 billion. Small companies are companies that have a size of less than $2 billion. If you look at the Russell 2000, that's kind of like the index that measures small companies in the same way the S&P 500 is the index that measures large companies. Like the S&P 500, though, it's not a pure representation of just small companies. And in fact, a lot of the companies in the Russell 2000 are actually considered mid-cap. So unlike the S&P, where you know if you list off the top 10 holdings, there's the Apples and the Googles and the Microsofts and the Facebooks and the Visas, you've heard of all those companies. You interact with them on a daily basis. Most of us do. Well, the Russell 2000 is going to be different. The top holding there is Shockwave Medical. Now, Shockwave Medical, it's almost a $10 billion company. They manufacture medical devices, but my guess is most of you don't know who Shockwave Medical is. I don't know who Shockwave Medical is. If you look at a lot of the top holdings, you probably won't recognize them the same way you would if you looked at the top holdings in the S&P 500. So when you're looking at the Russell 2000, if we're using that as a proxy for small caps, just keep in mind, you're probably not going to recognize most of these names. I start going down the list here, and the first one I really recognize that jumps out at me is Crocs. Crocs sells those horribly ugly shoes. I apologize if you think they look good. The kind of the foam clog type shoes. It's a $5.3 billion company. So that's a familiar holding. But a lot of these companies you probably haven't heard of yet. So most people look at this and say, why do I want to invest in these small companies? Well, a couple reasons. Number one, long-term return of small companies is about 12% per year. That's going all the way back to the 1920s, so that's a very strong return. And if you can get 12% per year, maybe it doesn't seem that different than 10% per year like the S&P 500 has historically returned, but it's a really, really significant difference when you compound that over time. The second reason is companies that are large today used to be small. Netflix, for example. The Netflix market capitalization in 2008 was $1.75 billion. So that's a small company. Most of us had not heard of Netflix in 2008. Maybe some of us had. They started mailing out those DVDs. Maybe you had a neighbor, or maybe you yourself had that subscription. But most people were not very familiar with them. Well, that $1.75 billion turned into almost $240 billion in 2020, rose to even more than that in 2021 before it's fallen back to where it is today. That's an enormous increase in value. Now, a lot of that value you wouldn't have gotten or you wouldn't have received if you waited until Netflix was the size it was today to start investing. It was those people that were investing in small companies, not knowing that Netflix was going to be what it became. Those are the ones that really received much of the reward for holding it. Domino's Pizza. Back in 2008, it was worth $250 million. Now, fun fact, after Netflix, I believe Domino's Pizza was the second best performing stock inside of the US. So you wouldn't typically think of a pizza company as being one of the best performers, but this is another thing that goes to show that it's the market has a wonderful way of surprising all of us. But Domino's Pizza, worth $250 million in 2008, it grew to $20.5 billion by 2021. And again, it was the second best performing US stock in the US after Netflix over that time period. So keep in mind, those large companies that we all know today, they were once small companies. That's why there's greater return potential, but there is also more risk. There are many small companies in the past that are still small. Maybe they're even smaller, or maybe they were acquired, maybe they're out of business. So a lot of these companies really won't amount to a whole lot over time. And in fact, statistically, most of them won't, but there will be a handful of them that become the next Netflix, that become the next Domino's, that become the next big thing. And when you own all the small companies, it's almost like going fishing and casting a wide net, knowing there's going to be some of those really big fish that you catch that really carry the performance over time of your portfolio as a whole. So looking at large companies, looking at small companies, those are great places to start. The next place I would go is looking at value versus growth companies. So what does a growth company mean? I think this is one of the most misleading things to a lot of people. Is you hear growth company, you think, well, of course I want to own a growth company. That means it's going to grow more, right? Well, not necessarily. And in fact, over time, value companies have actually outperformed growth companies. Here's what it is. There's different ways to measure the valuation of companies, but price to earnings is a common one. And here's why it matters. Let's assume I'm going to go buy a business. Let's assume there's a hamburger stand down the street from me, and I want to buy it because I love the store, I love hamburgers, and I want to start selling them. Well, I go to write a check to buy the business. How much am I going to write that check for? Well, I'm going to value the business based upon the business's earnings. So I want to know what's the level of earnings you have today, and then I'm going to apply some multiple to that. So if the stand is generating, let's say, $10,000 per year in earnings, I might apply a 5x multiple to that. Say, okay, I'll pay you $50,000 for this stand, knowing that it's going to then generate for me $10,000 of earnings on an ongoing basis. Now, I don't know that, but if I can keep it going as is, it will keep earning that. And hopefully, I can increase those earnings over time. Well, same thing with stocks. When you go to buy a stock, you're buying earnings. You're buying that company's current and future earnings. Again, that's what you're doing when you buy a stock. So you want to know, what are you willing to pay for those earnings? That's called the price to earnings ratio. Historically, depending on what time period you're looking at, the S&P 500 average price to earnings ratio, so if you look at all the earnings of the companies within the S&P, and if you look at all the prices of those companies, it's been between 15 and 19 times. There's times where it's been much higher, there's times where it's been lower, but let's just call it 17 for the sake of simplicity. So 17 times earnings means you could buy all the companies in the S&P 500 on average for about 17 times what they're earning in this year. Well, how do you compare a growth company to a value company? Let's compare it to that benchmark or that standard. If we look at a classic growth company, Tesla is kind of the first one that comes to mind. Now, one thing I want to say is big disclosure. I'm talking about specific companies on this podcast. This is in no way an endorsement or recommendation to purchase or not purchase any of them. This is simply for informational purposes. But Tesla is a classic example of a growth company. If you look at Tesla, today its price to earnings ratio is about 55, and at the end of 2021 is about 190. So much higher than the long-term average of the S&P that's around 17. Now, at one point, Tesla's price to earnings ratio is around $1,400. So if you're buying Tesla at that point and paying 14 times earnings, you're not buying it for its earnings today. You're buying it because of expectation of how many more cars it's going to sell or how much more it's going to be able to generate in revenue. So that's what you have to keep in mind when you're buying stocks, is the valuation isn't just based on today. There's an expectation that this has to happen in order for this valuation to make sense. So you can see that at almost 1,400 times, that is significantly greater than the average price to earnings ratio of the S&P 500. And it's because Investors in Tesla would say there's significantly greater growth potential within the company than there is today. So that growth potential is priced into the value of the stock, and you can see it at that level of price to earnings. Now let's compare that to a value stock. Again, not an endorsement, but just looking through some today, Goodyear Tires would be considered a value company. The price to earnings ratio on Goodyear is about 3.7 times. Now, I have no idea what Goodyear future is going to look like, but what that's saying is people who are investing in the company are probably assuming there's not a whole lot of growth from the company. They're saying, yeah, there's some earnings coming in, but we're not going to pay a huge multiple for those earnings because maybe we just don't expect those earnings to continue, or maybe we expect some headwinds for the company, or maybe we expect that things aren't just going to go or aren't going to go so hot over time. The interesting thing here is if you look at Goodyear and if you look at Tesla, and you say, what would you rather choose? What would you rather own? Well, most people would probably say Tesla. They'd say Tesla has way more growth potential over time, but here's the thing as an investor. It's not necessarily about how good the company is that you're buying. It's are you buying the company for the best price? So not always the best company, but what's the best price for a given company? Because you could buy an amazing company, but way overpay for it. On the other hand, you could acquire maybe a very average company, but acquire at a very attractive price, and that's what's going to drive your returns over time. And in fact, if you look at this, value companies historically have grown by about 11% per year since 1928, which has actually outperformed growth. So while growth companies in general seem like the better companies, it's value companies historically that have had a better return on investment, not necessarily just because of the company always, but because the price at which you were able to acquire that stock or that company. So now as we're looking at these different types of companies, large versus small, growth versus value, you could own large companies or small companies or value companies or growth companies in the US. You could own them internationally. This is just breaking down different types of stock characteristics. So if we look at the US as a whole, the US stock market, when you add up all the small companies and medium companies and large companies, some of them are going to be growth, some are going to be value, some are a blend. That makes up about 60% of the total global stock market, which means the remaining 40% is international. And international can be broken down as international developed and international emerging markets. So international developed just means international countries or companies within international countries that have more developed economies. They fit certain standards. So think the Italy's and Germany's and the UK and Japan and some of these more developed nations that just happen to be international. Now, you look at this, and a lot of people, they kind of have a fear or an aversion sometimes to investing international. Just seems more foreign. It seems, okay, I have less idea what's actually going on. But keep in mind this. Let's look at some of the top holdings. Nestle, well, they're from Switzerland. Samsung, South Korean company. Toyota, Japanese company. Siemens, Germany. Ferrari, Italy. Shell, British. So these companies, their household names, they're just not headquartered here in the U.S. So if we want exposure to all the different things that are out there, about 28% of the global market capitalization exists in international developed countries. So if 60% is here in the US, 28% is in international developed, that means the remaining 12% or so is in international emerging markets. Now these are countries like Czech Republic, India, Taiwan, Mexico, China, Russia, Brazil, Poland. And you hear these, and most people say, well, there's just a lot going on in these countries. They're not as developed. Maybe there's political uncertainty. Why would we invest there? Well, a couple reasons. Number one, if we look at every single country, and we look at the performance of every single country the last few years, here's the best performing country each year of the past few years. 2021 was the Czech Republic, up 55%. It's an emerging markets country. 2020, Korea, before it became international developed, it was up 46%. It was a top performing country in all the world. 2019 was Russia. It was up 51%, or its domestic stock market was up 51% in 2019. It's an emerging market. 2018, Peru, it was up 1.6%. So not big, but keep in mind, 2018, a lot of countries, a lot of stocks were down. The greatest developed country was Finland. It was down 3.4%. So Peru, even at just up 1.6, was the top performer. You have to go back to 2017 when Poland, an emerging markets country, returned 54.7%, and Austria, a developed international country, returned 58.3%. that was the last year that the top performing country wasn't a country within the emerging markets. So yes, there's issues in some of these countries. They don't have as much liquidity. They don't have as much visibility. They don't have as much transparency. They don't have the same status as the companies that we have here in the US, but there's still amazing opportunities. And if we're not investing there, we're missing out on some of those opportunities. And keep in mind that if you add up all the emerging markets, they make up about 12% of all global market opportunities when you're looking at where to invest your money. So that's a breakdown of what does it look like with the different types of investments you could invest in if you want to be an owner, aka owning stock. Now, the other side of the coin is being a lender. You don't own anything if you're a lender, but what you're doing is you're lending your money to a company, to a government, to some institution. Now, go back and check out episode number 134, where I say, why are bond prices falling and what can you do about it? Where I go in depth about different types of bond investments. But essentially what you're doing when you are a lender is you are owning a bond. You're purchasing a bond, which is you lending your money to an institution, they pay you back interest, and at the end of some term, assuming that institution is still solvent, you get your money back. Now, you can lend your money for short periods of time. So 1 month T-bills, for example, might be thought of as the most safe and conservative way to lend your money. You're literally lending your money to the US government for 30-day intervals at a time. Now, long-term, that's returned about 3.3%, so just slightly over inflation, but it's been very secure. There's never been a negative nominal return. I mean, there's never been a year where, at least on paper, your investment hasn't gone down in value. I say on paper because the real return has been negative in many years when you back out inflation, but that's a very safe, conservative thing that you can do with your money. You're just not going to get a whole lot of growth out of it. Well, you can also lend your money for longer periods of time. Long-term U.S. government bonds have averaged about 5.6% per year, so higher than the 3.3% that one-month T-bills have averaged. So you might hear that and say, well, what's stopping people from lending their money, in this case to the U.S. government, for long periods of time if you can get 5.6% long-term average doing that compared to only 3.3% for one-month T-bills? Well, what's doing it is the longer you're lending your money, the more risk you're accepting. Not necessarily the risk that you won't get paid back, although that's always a risk, even with the US government or any institution, that always is some inherent risk, however small it might be. But if you look at long-term bonds this year, 20 and 30 years bonds, they were down over 30% this year. As interest rates rose very quickly this year, I'm talking about 2022, bond prices fell very sharply. So what you're doing is, yes, you're getting a little bit more interest over time or a lot of bit more interest over time when you compound that over years, but you're accepting far more volatility, you're accepting far more uncertainty. And for most people, they're looking at this portion of their portfolio as the stability portion, as a secure portion. They don't want to go through that type of an experience, or if they do, they're going to go through it with the stock portion of their money where they're going to get a longer return over time. You can also lend your money to corporations. Now, the more you're doing this, you're accepting more inherent potential for default. And if a company defaults on its bond, they don't pay you back your interest, or they only pay you back maybe pennies on the dollar or a portion of it. Long-term, corporate bonds have grown by 6.1% long-term. So when you're a lender, you have to ask yourself, how long am I willing to lend my money for? The longer the term, the more risk you're accepting. And what's the creditworthiness of the institution I'm going to lend to? The US government's going to be far more secure than lending your money to a company that may or may not be solvent this time next year. So those are the things you need to look at. You need to structure your portfolio in a way where even within the conservative sleeve of your portfolio, you've got it almost laddered to maybe you own some short-term stuff, some medium-term stuff, some government stuff, some corporate stuff. You know, stuff isn't the technical term, but just talking about how do you spread your money out across different things, because they should all play a different role in your portfolio. And I've done a lot of episodes where I've talked about, well, how much needs to be in that more conservative bucket to protect against a downturn and what happens if you retire into a horrible bear market, but also talking about how much needs to be in that long-term, more growth-oriented bucket. Knowing that inflation is going to be something that you're fighting for the entirety of your retirement and you need your funds to be growing for you. So go back and listen to some of those episodes if that would be helpful. But I hope this was helpful as we just talk about what are the different components. What are you actually investing in? What's the long-term return you might expect from some of those things as you build a portfolio that makes sense for you? Now, if you're listening to this and you're saying, geez, this just sounds like a lot. I would love some help with this. This is what we actually do. This is what I do. So at Root Financial, what we do is we help people design portfolios. We help people with their financial planning. We help people with their retirement needs. So we're meeting regularly and doing all this for them so they never have to second guess what's going on within their portfolio. So if you're listening to this and say, I could really use some help with that, go to rootfinancialpartners.com, click start here, get connected with one of our advisors, and we'd love to walk you through how we do this. But for today, I think that's a great place to stop. Craig, thank you very much again for your question. I hope that was helpful. Thank you to all of you who are listening, and I'll see you all next time. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Ready for Retirement podcast. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe and let me know by leaving a 5-star review. And as always, for a list of the notes and the resources mentioned in today's episode, you can find those at the Ready for Retirement website, which is readyforretirement.co. That's readyforretirement.co. And if you have a question that you would like for me to answer on a future episode, then you can also go to the Ready for Retirement website, readyforretirement.co. There's a page called Submit Your Question where you can submit a question for me to answer on a future episode. Thanks as always for listening, and I'll see you next time.